This week's episode of Still Untitled is made possible with support from Microsoft Surface, introducing the new Microsoft Surface Laptop 3. With its beautiful touchscreen, you'll experience stunning graphics with razor-sharp resolution, now available with a 13.5 or 15-inch screen. And with the latest processors, there's no project that the Surface Laptop can't handle. It's both light and powerful, so you can get more done on the go. Visit surface.com/laptop3 to learn more. That's surface.com/laptop3. Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Norm.
I'm Adam.
Hello, it's Richard Taylor.
I'm Johnny Fraser-Allen.
Oh my goodness.
Hello, gentlemen.
Great to have you back with us.
Oh, thanks. It is so nice to be here.
Keep saying, when are you going to move?
Someday soon. So we're down here in New Zealand. We're visiting Weta Workshop. Before we get started talking about what's going on in some of our recent projects, I wanted to talk about my first 2 hours here in Wellington. Which is...
We all got to make it colorful.
I landed a few days ago at 9 in the morning, and Richard, you picked me up at the airport, brought me over here to Weta because you had a trailer full of concrete you wanted to take up north. And so we picked up the trailer, attached it to your ute, started heading through Wellington when the brakes on the trailer locked up. That's right, right?
Yeah, they did. For some reason, the mechanical failure in the brakes, which I'd already had repaired twice, they locked again. And needless to say, it turned to custard pretty quick.
It did. Our brakes started smoking. People in the street started yelling at us and pointing. And we're like, we know. And then this guy got out of his car and started pounding on our car and yelling at us to stop in the middle of traffic. It was very dramatic.
It was great that he was so caring. But the thing he didn't realize, it would have been irresponsible of us to pull over where he was suggesting, because we were in the busiest street in Wellington and we would have snarled the traffic up. So to the detriment of my trailer, it was worth pulling it around the corner.
Wow. And we pulled it around the corner into the parking lot of...
a brake specialist. We didn't even realize, did we, when we pulled in? But after we'd solved the calamity with the fire extinguisher this gentleman unceremoniously gave to me as I was trying to get my own one out of the car, and I've got Adam down, he's on his knees looking under the trailer, and I chuck him a fire extinguisher.
Wait, this is the best part, is that the fire extinguisher actually came from your wife, who happened to be driving by at that instant.
She was also armed with fire extinguishers. By total coincidence, my wife and daughter went past at the very moment we pulled into the car park.
This is my perfect story about how small and perfect New Zealand is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Tanya came to the rescue because we needed some counterbalance on the trailer.
Yeah,
remember that? So you and I could push it into the dockway of the actual brake specialist.
We took all the concrete out and put it in the wheel wells in the backs of both cars we now had. And it was like that myth, the famous story of the guy who went to Home Depot and tried to put all the materials for building a house onto a hatchback. And so you can see in this picture, he's got like a foot thick stack of plywood on the top of this hatchback. And what you can't see is he also has 1,200 pounds of concrete bags inside. Yeah. And the car is riding a half inch above the ground. We did this on Mythbusters. We were actually able to drive forward a few feet in this car. And that's what it felt like.
Yeah, it did. My wife's car, she's got a Toyota RAV4, and that was like under the weight of concrete.
And then we went up to the farm. And so all that was in the first 2 hours of landing. I felt completely at home.
And in the same weekend, you were driving diesel locomotives down New Zealand railway tracks and helping build things and make things, and it's fantastic.
A fantasy camp weekend.
I love that the nature of your creatively, frantically creative life has led to both you and your wife having to constantly carrying fire extinguishers. Anything can and will happen.
Yeah. Yes, invariably it does. And thankfully, my wife is extremely tolerant when it does happen.
Yeah.
Years and years and years ago, I pined after this woman who did not return my interest, but she did reiterate this story to me. At one point, she was in bed with her boyfriend at the time, whose last name, I might add, was Mateless.
Not in this situation.
Not a positive name. Anyway, they were snuggling in bed, and they were talking about you know, pillow talk about disaster. And he
when
said,
they saw you at the window?
No. Okay. No. He said to her, if there was a big earthquake, would you run over to my house? And she went, hell no, I'm going to Savage's. Nice. So at least I'm good in a crisis.
Yeah.
It is always so great to get down. It's been about 10 months since the mm-hmm. last time I yep. was here. And there's been, as always, a lot going on.
Yeah, we've been very, very busy. Huge number of projects have gone past. On average, we design on over 50 projects a year through our design studio, and we manufacture on average about 7 major film, television, or location-based experience projects a year. So in the 10 months since you were last here, a lot has happened.
I almost find that as a good cadence, because I was here 2 years ago, and we filmed, that's when we did Farewell to Arms, the short film with Adam the Armor.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was so much in the workshop we couldn't film, but we were being hinted at that was at work. And so maybe 2 years later now, some of that stuff is finally being, you know, going to cinemas soon. I think like Mulan's coming out soon.
Yes,
and
yeah, that's
a lot of
exciting.
That stuff is being worked on.
And we're in the thick of Avatar, which is mm-hmm. extraordinary for us, of course, because we so thoroughly enjoyed working on the original for a number of years, and we're now back in into that world.
Yeah. I'm curious, actually, as you know, you guys have been a special effects house from almost the very beginning of digital effects being used in film until now, when they've taken over so much of the actual business. That must change the very language with which you discuss with directors, because 20 years ago, a director needed to be pretty versed in a lot of different disciplines to do special effects.
Yes, but today, many directors have not got that depth of understanding of physical effects specifically,
right,
because they've grown up in recent years as a young filmmaker primarily, if not exclusively, working in digital effects. Mm-hmm. They can, in many cases, they're doing them themselves on their own computer, or they've put together a team of university graduates or friends that have helped them make their first short film and then their first feature film. So with some directors, it's a process of inspiring them to think about physical effects. And what's lovely today, though, is that we're getting some directors, and I Am Mother is a very good example mm-hmm. of a movie by an amazing director that came to us only focused on trying to do it with a physical suit.
And this is a film about a robot that's raising a child on a space station or on a...
Yeah.
Alone.
Mm. It's funny, I would say traditionally it would be done digitally.
Of course.
You know, over the last 10, 15 years, that's how it predominantly have been done. But he felt, and we entirely agreed, that the intimacy and connection between the child, which is the absolute critical part of the whole movie working, and the robot could not be realized if it wasn't through the connection of a physical actor in a suit working with the actress.
And there's a lot of people that watch this movie that don't even realize that there's an actor in the suit. They think it must be CG because we're inured to that.
Yeah. Even at Comic-Con, right? You brought the suit to Comic-Con, and I think I chatted with people who saw the suit behind the glass, and they thought it was just like a maquette or something.
Yeah, or a stand-in.
Exactly, that sometimes are built or, you know, to have physicalized digital things, but it's the opposite.
And you can totally understand why, because the vernacular of effects and film today is in that world. And it's not, I've never really seen it as a competition. Yeah. It's the right solution for the particular challenge. And I like the fact that we can complement Weta Digital and other companies as they do us.
And to be able to talk to each other, because you're doing stuff that has to match. I love the fact that in I Am Mother, the robot actor, our friend and your wonderful colleague, Luke Hawker, was also built the costume, worked on the team that built the costume. So he had to get bolted into this. We shot a test video about this, watching him get bolted into this robot costume, which is non-trivial for anyone, but made much easier by the fact that he helped design and build
it. And he's got no grounds for complaint. Right. He's going to have to suffer if he designed and built it along with the team.
Right.
The only other situation I've heard of where the artist was focused on directing the build and perform the character was Ron Muick as Ludo in Labyrinth, I think. I can't think of another situation where a main character in a movie that's a creature feature
was worked on by the person.
Yeah, the guys at Amalgamated Dynamics build the suits that they wear. Rick Baker's another excellent example.
Of course,
most famously in the De Laurentiis King Kong, where he saved the movie. In fact, he was the movie because of his suit-wearing capabilities. Yeah. Well, and I think you'll find many of the effects guys of the world have ultimately at some point been in suits that have ended up in the films.
Lon Chaney Jr.
Of course, most significantly.
Famously. Yeah. It gives them an intimacy with the suit and an ability to push it to its limit that an actor might not be able to find necessarily.
Yeah, yeah. Even my wife Tanya was, in fact, I think I was telling Adam recently on a discussion we were having that Tanya built the suit of Uncle Les in Braindead and then had to wear it, which is the one where the spine has been ripped out of the back of Les's body and the head's bobbing around. So Tanya spent the whole day gripping her ankles, bent double at the stomach, waddling around in a suit, ultimately became very unwell. But, you do what you got to do.
One of the things I love that you do, Richard, is you aren't just a service provider here. You very much take it as your personal mission to uplift and push out front New Zealand artists and craftspeople. And Johnny here is a beneficiary of that and also an incredible talent. And we've done a bunch of tested videos about your stuff.
Do you remember that first time we covered your labyrinth?
I remember it. as proud as I was to be part of a show that I was already a huge fan of. It's embarrassing for me in the sense that, how that tester video came about is Adam was here, and in passing in the hallway, I said, "Hi, Adam. I loved the Stanley Kubrick hedge maze you were doing. I'm working on a miniature of the labyrinth, which is kind of the same thing because they use the same hedge maze in both films." And Adam's like, "Oh, which room are you in? Sculpting. Can I come see you tomorrow?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure, mate." And that's as much as I thought it was me. So the next day, Adam shows in and is like, "Oh, so this is it." And while he's talking to me, someone's taking a light reading, someone's putting a microphone on me. And then I'm showcasing this very small, unfinished piece of what I know is going to be this big thing. And I look like it was some sort of, wetter helps the homeless sort of day. And after that video came out, I was like, I've got to take better care of myself and I got a haircut. And anyway, when I heard you were coming back the next time, I put a lot of work into making sure that I was going to show what I was intending to do in the first place. And you were going to catch me off guard again, just the response I got from that first video of showing what I considered incredibly average beginning of something was, oh, wow, okay, that's amazing. And so, then I went into the where do they get a load of me sort of mode and finished it sort of. And then the response to that was so informative and overwhelming that it completely directed the company I was able to form from more or less that video in some ways into the next product, which we'll be showing you tomorrow in a video, that was built directly around feedback from your content and videos, which is great because, I mean, that shows for me more clearly than anything that both of you have just created the most perfect content provider for the like-minded makers. And I love the word you use, that you keep using that word maker, and it's not just creatives, because there's all sorts of creative, but makers is...
I very specifically talk about making, and I don't limit it to physical objects. And the broadest definition I've come to is making is anytime you use your point of view to bring something that didn't exist into existence.
Yeah.
So that could be a dress or a poem or a song or a table. And when you say the forum for telling stories to makers, Richard and I were talking this weekend about one of my favorite books is Self-Reliance by Ralph Waldo Emerson. And one of the very first paragraphs he says, "To know that what is true in your private heart is true for all, that is genius."
Right.
And this is the reason your video resonated, specifically because you're so I say insane with the highest of compliments because sure. we all share the same insanity. It's such a pure love of bringing something extant that resonates to anybody that sees it, of like, holy cow, look at that. And there it is. And now you get to experience it.
And I might say, of course, that people such as Johnny and many others that has preceded Johnny and are here in the building mm-hmm. right now are very gracious in their thanks to myself and Tanya for giving them the environment, the platform, in some cases, the funding to do these things. But we benefit hugely too, as you know only too well, from your interactions with the people that you, both of you are building a community for. The opportunity to hang out and live in this in these worlds is phenomenally rewarding. And then to see how they then spurn on other people. And
that virtuous cycle that starts to build.
It's really, really actually quite beautiful.
In the book about this, it really resonated for me with how Weta and Richard have been for me. You're talking about when Jamie Heinlein gave you the opportunity to, when he hired you, he let you use his shop.
Yes.
And you learned so much from that. And from, you know, Richard hired me straight out of high school. And it really kicked off for me when King Kong wrapped up and there was kind of like some downtime of, you know, we didn't have work for everyone because Weta fluctuates and staff on a big project. I asked, well, is it okay if I, because I'd fallen in love with sculpting by that stage. I kept creeping off to the sculpting room in my breaks and annoying everyone there and tried to learn as much as I could. And I asked Richard if, even though I'm for a short period of time, however long it is, not working for Weta, would it be okay if I can keep coming in and teach myself how to sculpt? Of course. Didn't even know why I was asking it, you know? And that's when I made a life-size Hoggle and some other stuff, and my first sculpting lesson was with Richard in the kitchen just out there. I showed him my first sculpt of a goblin, and he got a teaspoon out of the drawer and said, like, the mouth should be deeper, and he's carving into my first sculpt, and you got to get used to that pretty quickly around here. And I remember in about 10 minutes, I felt like I'd had like a 3-year course in sculpting with a teaspoon, you know? And that went, it just kept going and going to the point. In 2007, I was in my early 20s, I did an entire exhibition where I redesigned The Labyrinth, I redesigned Wizard of Oz and Alice in Wonderland while listening only to Tom Waits because I was in my 20s. I thought that was cool to try and engage it into the artwork. Yeah. And Richard came up to the exhibition and brought the whole thing, you know, which funded the next 2 years of my artistic endeavors, which became this massive project called The Gloaming. Which Richard also, like Magwitch to Finn, or Pip as it was, in Dickens, you know, he acquired all of that from me, which enabled me to, so I was able to create these in the creative mecca chocolate factory that is Weta, which was enough. Just because you're surrounded by genius, right?
Yeah.
But Richard also was such a helpful benefactor of my work that he owns nearly all of it.
Can I just explain for a moment? One of the reasons that I purchased that first exhibition is that Johnny had it up for sale, and had I not, the artwork would have dissipated to the four corners.
Right.
And for a young artist, one of the most critical things is to have a collection that you can hang as a gallery of art.
Yeah.
And I saw so fundamentally in Johnny's early work that he would go on to do wonderful and great things. And if his collection wasn't held and held closely where he could access it or we could exhibit it, and we've held some beautiful exhibitions, even taking as far afield as Korea and exhibiting it there twice, so that people get to see all of his art. And that's really what motivated it, rather than... I just love Johnny's art. So, my father now has a very beautiful, almost shrine-like section of his house dedicated to Johnny's art, which is really nice.
Before we continue on with the show, I want to let you know that support for Still Entitled comes this week from Microsoft Surface, introducing the new Microsoft Surface Laptop 3. With its beautiful touchscreen, you'll experience stunning graphics with razor-sharp resolution. Now available with a 13.5 or 15-inch screen. And with the latest processors, there's no project the Surface Laptop can't handle. It's both light and powerful, so you can get more done on the go. Visit surface.com/laptop3 to learn more. That's surface.com/laptop3. Now back to the show.
And it is a virtuous cycle, right? Like Jamie knew, I didn't know that he knew this, but Jamie knew that letting me come in on weekends and have access to the shop to try stuff out made me more valuable to him. It was a direct exchange.
That's the comment that I was going to say. That's the comment that really resonated to me because I'm now art directing a big project for Richard and Weta that you've seen. Mm-hmm. And but so the reason Richard thought of me to art direct that is because I had made my own world of the Gloaming and Wandering Woods and Haggorthorn Hollow. I was able to do those. I was able to find my feet as an artist on those projects because of the opportunity Richard and Weta had presented me. Had they not presented those opportunities to me, I wouldn't have been the right fit to art direct this project for Weta, you know? And
this is why it's so important as a young person, I don't even think to limit it to creative enterprise, but to, when you're starting out in your career, to point to the things that you want to know about. And tell, if your boss doesn't realize that that's a value, then they're not a good boss. Because anytime one of your employees says, I'm curious about this thing, that means they're going to get really good at that if you give them that opportunity.
Of course, you want every person that's working with you to be highly inquisitive, highly motivated, driven to explore and experience their own worlds, because that is only helping to hone their craft and in turn, create something very special around the team.
And I know that what you love to do here, and it's so inspiring, and you talk to people here and they started in one department, they moved to another, they did a third, they're learning something else. And it's not like any kind of creative dictatorship where there's one creative mind and just spills out to everybody else. It's that you're counting on everybody on the team to bring their creativity to bear on the thing that they're working on.
We have literally had the young gentleman that is our cleaner, he looks after the facility, make a suggestion which we've actioned. Because why shouldn't it come from anywhere?
It doesn't matter where it comes from.
The only time Richard's ever discouraged me is perhaps I could be more tidier in my workspaces because I work in chaos. Richard taught me something quite valuable myself one day after years of my workspace being clutter. He just said to me, you had this resigned tone. It's like, you do really need to work in chaos, don't you, Johnny? And I didn't realize that it was completely true. But I'm going to try, after every tool's a hammer, I'm really quite interested in doing some knolling and cleaning my workspace up and being more efficient. But the other discouragement is maybe I shouldn't use power tools quite so much.
Well, it is actually, it's fascinating when you get feedback about your process and it changes the way you think about it. Because something I pointed out to someone the other day is that very few times in our lives does someone come to us with their creative output and says specifically, please tell me what you think about this.
Right.
Right? It's a huge responsibility when someone really does ask for no holds barred, tell me the real thing. And giving someone that perspective, like, you like to work in chaos. Like, okay, that is a thing. And does that match with all the other ways in which I want to work? Mm. And maybe it does. And maybe it doesn't.
When I get to meet a lot of people that have done creative things and they want to share them with me, and I will ask them, would you like me to look at this with you and give compliment, or would you like feedback? And I always ask because you need to check, because for some people it's their life blood has flowed into it and they're not here to get critical feedback. They're here to have acknowledgement for what they've achieved. But those that do ask for critical feedback then will get a very thoughtful but very honest appraisal of the object or the sculpture or so on. You know, I interview people in this room at the far end of this table and do a great number of people every year. And I just jump back for a moment, Adam, to something that you mentioned when you were talking about what creativity and the ability to make or, you know, means to you. And I say to a number of people that come in every year who say, I'd love to work at Weta, but I've never done anything. Hmm. And I said, have you ever done some macrame? You call it macrame, I think. Or do you do felting? Or maybe you make bedspreads? Or, you know, there's got to be something. And invariably, the person, of course, mm-hmm. has some craft that they didn't think was worthy of showing because it wasn't this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's all about hand skills, color, balance, capability, dedication, irrelevant to what the actual product is.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be a makeup or a creature.
No.
And we have found, with reference to your comments on the items that you were saying had detail beyond detail, our most extraordinary person that does beading here, extremely complex beading, would never have thought to bring me initially a piece of beading, never thinking that it would connect the dots to a job. But that person's hand skills are beyond anything you could almost imagine and therefore beneficial.
Well, so this is an art director at Industrial Light and Magic told me this thing years ago, which I really liked, because someone said to me, oh, you work at ILM, I have a digital portfolio. Would you ask one of the digital people there what they'd like to see in a portfolio? And the head of digital said, they've got to bring in something that I know what it looks like. Because if you bring me a digital portfolio of stuff you've designed, it's probably great. But I'm not going to hire you right away to design. I'm going to hire you to solve problems for me. If you bring me a digital drawing of a 57 Cadillac and it's perfect, I'll know.
Yeah.
And that will tell me that you're useful to me.
Do you know that very thing?
Yeah, that's partially what got me the job here, because I came to Richard 19 years old, and I'd completely redesigned about 17 different characters from The Wizard of Oz.
Right.
But I did them three different ways. And I remember Richard saying, you have no idea how many people bring me a design and which is just one design. It's like, this is what Aragorn should have looked like, or something like that.
Right.
But the fact that I'd shown three very different ideas of that one character helped. But the reason I chose Wizard of Oz was because it was a fantasy film that, even if you've not read the book, Wizard of Oz to me felt like a universal language that everybody understood.
Right.
So when I said this is the Tin Man, Richard knew the background to the Tin Man and why. Because the three drawings looked completely different, and Scarecrow, Lion, everyone knows these characters. I thought ahead about, I could say, this is Raxna the Great from Quiffalon 7 or something. Right. And it's like, yes, it is.
Sure. You know, well, and this is the thing, is that a lot of people who are doing what they might think of as crafting at home, a word I hate, where they're, look, a lot of beginning makers begin with recapitulation. They make something that they've seen and they want it.
Mm.
And they think that cheapens what they've done because they've made an imitation. That's the very thing that makes them valuable.
Exactly. I learned how to sculpt from remaking Hoggle.
Yes.
And I chose Hoggle because I knew I'd never be satisfied until I got my favorite character right. But if I was sculpting a goblin, there was no point, like my version of a goblin, at any point that could have been, my version of a goblin. But I'd push myself further than I would have because I was trying to capture something that meant a lot to me, and I became a better sculptor for it. And it also just awoken this demon for sculpting in me because I enjoyed the process so much.
I want to say, in terms of encouraging people to work, it was really lovely on Saturday when you picked me up. We came by here and we did a sweep through the shop to just say hi to whoever was here. And there's about 10 or 12 people in various parts of the shop, and many of them were working on their own projects.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Many of them were working on their own cosplays.
Yeah, cosplays,
and their own art projects.
Helmets, art projects. I know, it's lovely. I feel very fortunate that we can actually offer people that environment. And, you know, and then there's people such as David Tremont, of course, who you've kindly supported so significantly with your comments on his books and so on, who is always in here because that is literally the lifeblood that flows through him. If he's not touching the tools and he's at the materials building something, then he's not feeling fulfilled. Mm. And, you know, I am here at pretty extreme hours, as you can imagine, and David is never not at his desk. Come New Year's Day, Christmas Day, his birthday, he'll be there at the desk building. And that's neat.
It really is.
I trick myself into that I'm taking a break because Saturdays is my break day, and I use Saturday to build a Star Wars spaceport in my garage. But that's still work.
Yeah.
And I'm still, like, I probably stress over that more than the stuff I should be doing because it needs to be perfect or whatever. But that's my weekend treat to myself. But I'm still going to be doing something.
It's your refueling.
Yeah. That's exactly what I do, as you're aware.
Yeah, me too.
To a much finish hard all week and then the weekend.
Every Monday morning, these guys come in and I built some stuff over the weekend. I didn't film it. I'm sorry. I want to say I have this feeling, and I have not told you this, Richard, but we spend a lot of time chatting and doing podcasts in this room. We have all these amazing collectibles around. And I want to say the prevailing thing I think of as I walk through and look at each collectible is I think about the final paint job. I think about the sculpt and the detail and all that. But for me, that any one of these, the most fun part is those last washes that take your paint job and bring it all together.
Yeah. And I actually think it was the signature that we brought to the collectibles business. You know, there are incredible artists in the collectibles business. And but when we had the opportunity to get into this business, when we got a chance to collaborate with Sideshow on the early Lord of the Rings collectibles, which are actually right behind your head by total chance, it was exactly the desire that we had to bring the world onto the characters, the mud of the world onto the characters, the pigments that we then carried through to the collectibles. And people weren't really doing that at the time. Yeah. People wanted to collect beautiful, shiny, perfect collectibles. So that was a nice opportunity to do something really special. And I agree, I go down and enjoy art directing that final pass when I get the chance.
It's so thrilling when you... I've talked about it on Tested a lot that weathering always requires at least three different colors, no matter how light your weathering is. And that fact is that second and third pass of like a light brown or a green or whatever it is that made the things pop is always a magic trick to me. It always...
Absolutely. Yeah. Just last night, after you guys left the building, I went down to check. I'd asked if I could go and check some hanging sheep carcasses that our guys had spent the whole afternoon airbrushing perfectly, and they were looking pretty good. But they weren't right. Yeah. So what I did is I mixed up three tubs of sloppy paint and tipped them from the top.
I saw those this morning. Okay, I love that bit. Yeah.
Let them run down and get into all the creases and crevices and look like it was some form of rot that had set in.
Yeah.
And I said to the young chap that had done a beautiful job painting them, you know, let the gravity in nature take over and bring this. And I was taught that lesson myself. We were working on a TV commercial 30 years ago for Folgers coffee beans, and these two brilliant model makers that had built this rock face that the actor was going to climb up was in there with tiny brushes tickling away like this, and the art director, a guy called Rick Coford, just walked in, picked up a bucket of paint and just threw it like this all over their paint job. Literally, like exactly as I describe it, just chucked the paint. And it was like this huge intake of, and these two guys were, you know, somewhat taken aback. But of course, over the next 3 or 4 minutes, the paint settled and ran I was like, boy, there's a life lesson in model making right there. So when I aged my G-scale railway carriages and locomotives, same thing. I put the pigments on, spritz with methylated spirits, and then don't touch it. Just let the world do what the world does.
You and I shared the experience that, like, most of my best paint jobs are happen as I'm trying to scrape off my worst paint job.
Yeah, fix a bad paint job. Yes, I think we've all... The trick is to know that you're actually making it better as you try and fix it.
Well, there's Kurt Vonnegut wrote years ago about his daughter when she was in second grade, and she was coming home with these artworks that were... masterpieces of abstract art.
Yeah.
And he went in for the parent-teacher meeting and he was like, everything your class produces is amazing. And the third graders aren't doing it. It's the second graders. And she's like, well, second graders are freer with their minds than third graders. And all I do is I take the drawing away from them when the time is right.
Yeah.
She says, stop.
Yeah, extracts.
Yeah. It's that kind of gut instinct thing. The best thing I've learned from my own work in the last couple of years was I love drawing with pencil and stuff, but I've learned to not now draw for the finished illustration, especially when I'm designing a character. I don't worry about rub out marks or anything. I just draw it as fast and as fluent as I can, and then that piece of art is what informs the finished thing. But I come up with and if I try to replicate that, well, those are some cool things, and I try to redraw it properly or whatever, what have you.
Yeah.
It never captures the same angles and the life that's in that sketch.
The vitality.
So I'll just trace over that and clean up the line work from the vitality of that. Sometimes.
When you go to his workroom, they are literally scattered across the floor like newspaper.
Yeah.
And I go in and I start gathering them up and I'm like, oh, how can you be so... Because they're so exquisite. And they just he's just drawing them and almost chucking them off the desk.
I'm trying to catch up with what's happening as well.
Well, and that's the thing is that we're looking like when we're generating something, we're looking for that what feels like an accident. It's not. It's part of the process and the structure of the process. But we're looking for that thing that's like that catches my eye. This is the thing, and we grab that and we start to pull. That's. I mean, there's no more exciting moment at the bench than that.
So and you just did this, right?
Yeah.
That is a universal gesture in almost every culture for trying to sense the essence of creativity.
Right, I'm rubbing my two fingers against my thumb.
Yeah, John Howell does it when he's trying to capture the moment. When I'm with Chinese creatives, which I work with frequently up in China, they'll feel the moment between their fingers, and I see it commonly amongst people that are trying to find that moment. And I wonder if there's something in it.
It's totally true. It's also the universal symbol for money, right? But or value.
Maybe it is that.
I always like the fact that was the direction Steven Spielberg gave to Alfred Molina as Harrison Ford was about to tip the bag for the idol. And he goes, oh, like this. Yeah. And you see in the behind-the-scenes material that Spielberg comes up with this in that moment and goes, you know what? Put your fingers up and do this. Wow. And it's the gesture of value.
Yeah. Maybe it's finding the value of the idea.
Yeah. This is my rolling a ball of plasticine to keep it warm for the next thing I change. So I'm always sculpting like this. But maybe
that's we're also feeling for that tiny little. It's like those of us who work and build stuff. I'm sure you've had it when you grab a microfiber cloth and you feel it grip on every torn piece of skin on your calloused hands.
Of course,
we're looking for that tiny little thread, that little thing that tells us, something's happened here. And again, it's pulling on those threads until they're ropes, and pulling on those until something.
When I was a child, we didn't have cotton. Sheets on our beds. We had these horrible synthetic sheets that had been handed down, and that was one of the worst sensations. And you get into bed, and every little nick that you got off your craft knife and your would catch on these synthetic sheets. And say the same thing.
I have an almost. I don't mind fingers on a chalkboard at all, but grabbing a microfiber cloth elicits that feeling from me. It feels genuinely true. This is something you didn't know about me.
ASMR.
For me, it's tin foil. Milk bottle tops, which we used to get, remember, on the top, in the back of your teeth. We used to challenge each other to, because, you know, with really crappy fillings, which probably you guys of your generation, we got those terrible amalgam fillings, and you chew on a piece of tinfoil.
When I was a kid, The Spy Who Loved Me was the first James Bond film I saw, and I came home and I took a pack of Wrigley's gum, which came in the silver foil, each piece of gum, and I took a silver foil and I sculpted it on my upper teeth. And I took a piece of foil, I sculpted it on my bottom teeth, and I'm like, I just and then I literally started to shriek as the tinfoil came up. My fillings, and it was basically like filling your mouth full of 9-volt batteries.
Yes, exactly.
It's the worst feeling.
That's exactly the sensation. We used to lick the end of a 9-volt battery.
Did you ever meet Richard Keelan passing before he passed in all your puns and stuff?
I did not.
I mean, he would love that story.
Do you know where I saw that film? I lived 5 kilometres up the road from King's Seat Hospital, which was a psychiatric hospital in South Auckland. And the kids, were invited, the children of the doctors and nurses that served there, were invited to go and watch a movie with the patients there. And I was invited as a guest. I was about 8 years old, whatever it was. And I was invited along to go and share watching this James Bond movie with this group of people. And it was very colourful and very noisy, to say the least, but joyful all the same.
So. I don't know that if I've told you this or if you know this, but the very first two of your films that I saw, Bad Taste, or Dead Alive, which Brain Dead,
yeah.
I saw the Brain Dead version. And Meet
really?
The Feebles.
Okay, yeah. Great.
And I saw them in the Pixar screening room in Pixar's first
offices. Yeah, no, you did tell me
Richmond,
that's
California.
Bizarre. Wow. How on earth they got them.
My friend Rick Sayer, early employee at Pixar, used to have screenings for his friends of weird movies. And he was like, just come out, you're going to see this nearly pornographic Muppet film and it's going to change your life.
Yeah. those are the films that when I think when Bernard Hill was offered the part of Theoden, and he called Peter and said, I've just watched, okay, he didn't know who Peter was, so those are the two films he watched. And he told Peter, and then he said Peter was on the other line, and there was a pause, and he just said, oh, you didn't. But it came out anyway.
And on that note, yeah. I know we've gone for hours and hours, but thank you both so much for your time. Yeah. We have so much we're filming here that we can't wait to share with our audience. I know that you guys can't wait to share with the world.
Thank you so much for your generosity, and we feel so much like family when we come here.
You are.
Just love you guys.
Yeah.
Come to San Francisco, Johnny.
Yeah, I'll come out this year.
Good.
I've got a con I got to be at, so.
We're going to build something in the cave while you're there. You too, Richard. You have not been to the cave yet.
No,
we'll have
I
to
haven't.
Work that out.
No.
I've been to it in VR.
Right.
And it was so real. It's in here that I was worried to speak in case Adam put his thumb through the bandsaw. It was really like being there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much.
Great.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.